Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. And a warm welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. I am the Bill Arnold part of that sentence. I am awfully glad that you joined me today. Three out of the four voices in my head said, get a good cup of coffee before the show starts. I definitely need to have my game today because coming on to the program will be Ed Stetzer in just a few minutes. Sheila Heen's going to be with us, Carolyn Weber, and Trillia Newbell. That's the lineup. It's going to be a great one. I'm very excited. Ed Stetzer's got a new book out called Christians in the Age of Outrage, How to Bring Our Best When the World is at Its Worst. I can't think of a more timely book than this, and it's going to be interesting because I've got all kinds of questions lined up for Ed, and he doesn't miss a beat, so it's going to be fun to be chatting with him in just a minute. He's already on our studio line, so I'm not going to waste any more time, but I do want to get today's show off with a passage from Psalm 103. Starting in verse 17, it says, but from everlasting to everlasting, the Lord's love is with those who fear him, and his righteousness with their children's children, with those who keep his covenant and remember to obey his precepts. Seems like there is a great disobedience in today's world. I'm going to talk to Ed about that in just a minute. It is already going on 6 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break and bring on Ed Stetzer.
Have you ever wished you could listen to your favorite radio program when you wanted to? That way you'd never miss a program you really wanted to hear, simply because your program came on when you had an appointment, you were at work, or something urgent came up. And for those really busy days, you could listen early in the morning or late at night when things were calmer, and you could take the time to reflect and meditate on what you heard. Well, you can listen to your favorite programs whenever you want. Download the Faith Radio app by searching Faith Radio in the Apple Store or Google Play Store to gain instant access to Faith Radio programs and previous shows. It really is that simple. Search and subscribe to your favorite program and listen anytime. Download the Faith Radio app today and don't miss a thing. Once again, go to iTunes or Google Play on your mobile device and search for Faith Radio to download the free Faith Radio app and start listening today.
Welcome to the show, Bill Arnold. It's 6 minutes after. We're awfully glad that you've made your way to the show. And if you're just climbing into the car, I hope your work day's been good. And if you're just getting ready for what's next in your day and you're taking time to tune in, that means the world to me. So thank you so much. Ed Stetzer is my guest. He holds the Billy Graham Distinguished Chair for Church Mission and Evangelism at Wheaton College. He also serves as the executive director of the Billy Graham Center. And I think the last time he was on the show that I had a chance to talk with him, I marveled at how many notes I took, because when guests come on and all you do is take notes, you sometimes feel like you're really a bad host because it almost takes you out of the interview because you're so busy absorbing. And he's agreed to come back on the program. Hello, Ed. How are you?
Hey, I'd love to be here. And if you're taking notes, we could talk about getting you in our graduate school here at Wheaton College. We have master's degree programs and more.
First of all, you have two earned doctorates and two master's degrees. Do you have any personal hobbies?
You know, I am often asked that question, and to be perfectly honest, I have hobbies. They include animals, because my middle daughter loves animals. They include music, because my older daughter loves music.
Fantastic.
And they include watching my youngest daughter do dance. So my hobbies are largely driven around my children's lives.
Yeah, and that's not meant to be anything other than this has got to be so time-consuming.
Well, that was a while ago. You know, I finished my second doctorate in my 30s, and I'm no longer in my 30s, let's just say.
I get that. But you've got great humility, because I think for the longest time you were only Ed Stetzer, and then I never thought, well, you're really Dr. Ed Stetzer and Dr. Ed Stetzer.
I think the two doctorates cancel each other out, and so I just go with Ed. And, you know, it's the thing is, doctorate, you know, what does that even mean to people?
When I
write a scholarly article for a journal, I'm Ed Stetzer, PhD.
But I get it.
When I'm with you, we're just friends.
I get it, Ed. I appreciate that. Now, I love this book, Christians in the Age of Outrage, because I cannot believe how timely this book is. And, you know, how to bring the best when the world is at its worst. And it feels like that right now.
It really does. And people, it's deeply concerning because I think it impacts our Christian witness. You know, a lot of Christians, this is not just about what Christians should do. It's also about how we respond to what the world's doing, because there's outrage directed at us. There's a lot of outrage that comes from us. You know, a lot of Christians are being discipled by their cable news channel. They're being spiritually shaped by their social media feed. And that's creating, outrage from us. You know, the picture on the front cover, I didn't design the front cover. I'm just going to brag on the designers at Tyndale. They did a great job.
It's fantastic.
It's kind of a sheep. And then you see right at the end is the mouth of a wolf. And I think for all of us, we don't want to be that. We don't want to become the kind of people that some Christians now, Bill, I click on a social media link. Somebody says something horrible to me on Facebook or Twitter, and I look at it and I click and I say, what kind of person says this? And I click and the bio says, I'm a Christian. And I think to myself, this is not who we are. We are not people of the pitchfork. We're people of the towel, like Jesus picked up the towel and served others. And so Christians in the Age of Outrage is a manifesto about a better way to engage culture.
Mm-hmm. But if this particular listener or, you know, whoever is criticizing you said, I have to take this Ed Stetzer to school and teach him something, that's not the way to do it either, is it?
Well, first of all, I don't mind people correcting me, and people can teach me lots of things. I think I've learned from my critics, and I try to do that pretty consistently. But I just think in this moment, what we need when the world is so broken and angry is Christians who want to go and show a better way. And I think there is a lot of temptation, and there's a lot of people calling us a different direction. But Jesus has a plan for his church. And yeah, so I mean, who would guess right now? You know, we're in the middle. It just keeps getting worse and worse. I mean, every week, I think the country can't get more divided, and it does. But you know, it's moments like this when the Lord works in powerful, powerful ways. And I believe that's what he's going to do. And that's what Christians in the Age of Outrage is all about.
Yeah, and I love that. And I want to backtrack just a little bit and say, yes, I indeed myself learn from critics all the time. I guess it was the tone.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the meanness, that the mean-spiritedness that you don't expect from other Christians, I guess.
Yeah, and we do see that. I mean, and it's interesting because, and they just sometimes say things like, well, I'm just trying to be frank. Well, yeah. if your name's not Frank, maybe don't try to be frank.
Yeah.
But what I would say is that people will say things, and you've seen this too, they'll say things on social media they would never say to somebody in person. And one of the, we have a whole chapter in Christians in the Age of Outrage on getting your social media under the lordship of Jesus Christ. Because it shouldn't look like that. You know, I have people in my life who I've given permission to say to me, Ed, man, don't say that on social media. You know, and I'm not anti-social media, man. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. I'm not on Pinterest because I'm a man. But I'm on all those other social media outlets, and I'm for it. It's just I'm for us using it well,
mm-hmm,
and for the glory of God.
Yeah. Well, Ed, I'm on chapter 2 of your book, and I'm looking at some of the outrageous antics of Christians online.
Yeah,
yeah.
So it's common. You know, the book starts with these different examples, and one of the first examples is this internet pastor who in 2015 tells us, quote, Starbucks hates Christmas, or excuse me, Starbucks hates Jesus, unquote. And he says that because they made a red cup. And I'm not guessing many of your listeners remember this because it was on the nightly news for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem was Starbucks, he said, well, Starbucks removed Christmas from their cups. Starbucks never said the words Christmas on a cup, ever.
Right.
And so, I mean, they had like a snowman once, and they had like a snowflake, and this guy gets on these red cup kind of tirade. It goes all over the news. You know what? It makes us look foolish. That's what it did.
Mm-hmm.
It made Christians look foolish that we believe these faux controversies and this fake outrage. And I got to tell you, millions of people watched the video, and millions of Christians shared it. And the end result was, I mean, here we are. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, the life. And we're people of the truth because we're people of Jesus, and yet we're spreading misinformation. Now, I'm sure me and Mr. Starbucks owner aren't going to see eye to eye on stuff, but to lie about him so we can make some sort of Christian point, and that's the kind of outrage we don't need as Christians.
Yeah. Now, Ed, another antic of a Christian being online is the vengeful outcast, someone who, tells the world everything wrong about their old camp.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. And we see this all the time. We actually, in the book, in Christians in the Age of Outrage, we walk through sort of a few ways that people sort of get. And the vengeful outcast is, you know, a lot of times for us, you know, where most of your listeners, you and I, are evangelicals. It's kind of that ex-evangelical who's just furious and mad, and they put things like empty the pews, and,
mm-hmm,
and sometimes they're actually genuinely hurt, and we should listen, care, and be concerned. But they kind of burn paths through their opinions, and the end result is that people turn them off and don't listen to them. Now again, for me, I try to listen some. It depends on how they respond, but man, there are There are a lot of Christians doing a lot of outrageous things online.
Yeah, and what about the person that's always looking for a controversy?
Yeah, for oh my gosh, the controversy hunter, we called him or her.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. This is the thing that grieves me, Bill, is, you know, I forget the magazine, news magazine, but remember in 2016, we later found out, and everyone agrees with this. This is not, you know, people are still debating about the Russia stuff in 2016. That's not what I'm talking about. Everyone agrees that Russian social media people engaged and tried to get and convince people to be divided. And one of the groups, according to news story after news story, that they had success with was actually conservative Christians who were willing to believe the worst, willing to spread the worst controversies or the worst words about other people. And what I would just say is that doesn't honor Jesus. And what people think, sometimes people hate those they disagree with them more than they love the truth. And they just want to spread the worst thing possible they heard about somebody so that they can actually maybe undermine them. And that, man, again, that does not honor the Lord.
Mm-hmm. Ed, talk a little bit about the passive-aggressive subtweeter. I found that to be very provocative. What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, you know, every time something – you know, subtweet is something where you say, you know, maybe you didn't like something somebody said, and they said something, I don't know, about music. And you say, man, there sure are a lot of people out there who say stupid things about music. So that's kind of a subtweet. Mm-hmm. People maybe know what you said, and they kind of get it, and – they think they've kind of avoided the fight, but they really haven't. And it's sort of a way to maybe say something about something without being too controversial about it. And so, yeah, so I think ultimately, man, just be truthful. But, you know, I think you said you're in the second chapter. As you go to the end of it, you'll see there's a whole section on solutions. I'm not just here to point out problems.
No, I
talk
know.
About solutions. Is winsome love is one of the sections. So how would, you know, what would Jesus tweet might be a good question for us to ask.
Yeah. So what do you think right now, how do you think Christianity is coming across to people in the world today?
Well, it's mixed, but I think for a lot of people, it's coming across as out of mainstream culture. One of the things a little later in the book we talk about is that 50, 60, 70, 100 years ago, Christianity, the Judeo-Christian consensus was mainstream culture. And what we believed about, like, the uniqueness of Christ wasn't shocking to people. We believe he's the only way, or what morality is, or marriage, or whatever. Now, fast forward decades later, now we're outside of the mainstream. The mainstream culture believes that everyone finds their own way. It's the Oprahfication of American spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone finds their own way, their own path. Just don't judge other people, you know. And so what happens now is as culture has changed, in many ways we've lost our home field advantage. We're now out of the mainstream of culture, which is why sometimes some of this stuff is directed, why outrage is often directed at us. You know, you remember early on in the book, I think it's the first chapter, I talk about a guy named Phil Anschutz, and he's a well-known Christian businessman, billionaire, I think. And he owns a lot of things. He owns a music company called AEG, which has a rock and roll festival called Coachella. And, you know, rock and roll festival, you kind of expect it to be probably not exactly a bastion of conservative Christian values. But he's owner, part owner, whatever. So then the news breaks in this magazine called Pitchfork. It's a music magazine, that this guy who owns Coachella is a Christian who gives to anti-LGBTQ organizations. And it just, this is making the news everywhere. It gets picked up everybody. And then they name the organizations that he's contributed to, these horrible anti-LGBT organizations. Well, let me just tell you just a few. They named them in the magazine. They were shocking. Are you ready? The Navigators, Dare to Share Ministries, great Greg Steer, shout out. The Center for Urban Renewal, Movie Guide, which I still use, Young Life. The biggest was actually to Young Life. You know, those radical anti-everybody people at Young Life. Mm-hmm. That's all of them. And so Young Life is now... him giving to Young Life is now something worthy of a scathing article and outrage because they hold the Bible's view of marriage. Well, so the culture has shifted so much now where a Christian business owner owns a music festival through a holding company, you know, I'm not rich people, but that's how rich people do it. Yet he's now attacked, you know, magazine Pitchfork takes up the pitchfork and goes after him. And so here's the culture we live in. We are now outside of the mainstream. But you know what? Christianity thrives when it's at the margins, when men and women are changed by the power of the gospel and seek to live out its truths in their communities. So I'm not Bill, I'm not discouraged. Now, partly I've read the end of the book and Jesus wins, but I'm not my book. I mean, he wins in that book too, but the Bible.
Book. Yeah, right.
The big book. Yeah. And so I'm not discouraged, but I still think that for all of us, it's really key to live differently. And again, not be people of the pitchfork, take up the pitchfork at our enemies, but people of the towel and serve others in the name of Jesus.
Yeah, smart and charming. You're amazing, Ed. Let me take a little break when I come back. More with Ed Stetzer. It's 19 minutes after the hour. I'll be right back. Ed Stetzer is my guest, and if you missed any of this interview so far, you're going to want to rewind. So go to myfaithradio.com and check out the podcast, because you're going to want to hear this. Ed, of course, holds the Billy Graham Distinguished Chair for Church Mission and Evangelism at Wheaton College. And we're talking about his book, Christians in the Age of Outrage, How to Bring Our Best When the World is at Its Worst. And I was thinking of the worldview, the Christian God-shaped worldview, Ed, that we should have. And when we participate in the outrage, are we showing our best to the world?
No, not at all. I think there's a time and a place for being angry. Jesus was angry. You know, I'm angry. My heart's broken. And there's an anger that ties into it with injustice, with, you know, life not valued. I'm not going to list a thousand things. But ultimately, I mean, 2,000 years of Christian history tells us that the path forward to engage a culture that's filled with outrage is not to turn the volume up to 11 and yell louder than they are. And that's what a lot of people think. I mean, the book's not a social media book. It has one chapter on social media. The chapter right after that is about engaging your neighbors. You know, but for all of us, I think we've got to resist the self-isolation that comes with only being around people who agree with you. And in process of doing so, that means we're going to have to find ways to build relationships. And what I loved about the book is all the examples. So 50 plus examples of Christians, real life examples of Christians who found a better way, mm-hmm. who found a better path. And in the process of doing so, they got some great stories. You know, I think the first story in the book is Caleb Kaltenbach, who you may have had on your show.
I have had him on my show, yeah.
Exactly. And Caleb's great. But what people don't often know about Caleb, you know, he writes his book, Messy Grace, about his, he was raised in a same-sex household, his two moms, and then he becomes a Christian and adopts evangelical beliefs about marriage. And he tells that story. But what people don't often know is he's the Costco Bible guy. And so he walks into a California Costco, sees the Bible in a fiction section, tweets it because he thinks it's funny. Some kid mislabeled the Bible as fiction.
Wow.
And it gets picked up on national and then global news. And people are saying, let's boycott Costco. And he's like, whoa, 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 whoa. I just thought it was funny. And he says later, you know, the CEO of Costco is a devout Catholic. So here's Caleb. He gets caught up in the outrage. And he says, because you can see how quickly, man, it's one tweet away, and he's on the front page of, well, I won't mention the news channels, but he's on the front page of news magazines. And yet, here's a guy who's walking through this. And by the way, both those who raised him, both his moms who raised him, are now Christians and have been changed by the power of the gospel. And so we see this. And I think, Caleb, what a great example. But here's the great thing. There are thousands and thousands of people like that, and we just need millions more. And I think that's the key.
I agree. Ed, in your book, you talk about Scripture calls us to speak out in two respects, sacrificially and lovingly. Would you say a little bit about each?
Yeah, for sure. And let me start with the second one. So part of the challenge for a lot of people is they don't know what it means to speak out lovingly. I mean, there are things I need to say and do because it's the right thing to say and do. So I think when we speak out lovingly, we see actually that we're, and we talk specifically in the book about winsome love, but I also think sacrificially. We look at the scripture, Proverbs 51, 8 and 9 says, open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all who are destitute. Open your mouth, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and the needy. Well, there's a place to speak up and an essential place to speak up, but also lovingly, right? Remember, speak the truth in love. Mm-hmm. We're to grow up in all ways into him. So I think when we speak up that way, again, not just, you know, here's the thing. For all I know, Bill, you have worked hard to avoid this, but people speaking up about this current Supreme Court nominee process, and I'm mm-hmm. not going to go far into this, so don't worry, but there's so many people who are experts on exactly what happened, when happened, and what we should do, and they don't have the FBI report. They're not in the Senate. They're not going to be a casting vote. And what I would say for some people, we need to ask the question, Should we speak up in this situation? And if so, how could we do so in a way that honors truth, that also honors people who may have been victimized or survivors of abuse? And I think when you speak up sacrificially and lovingly, you're asking not just what point do I want to make, but who's listening and why does that matter?
Mm, I love it. So, Ed, let's just talk about how, you know, Christians can navigate today's, you know, world, society, culture, whatever word you want to use. What little advice, because there's outrage out there and it's messy.
Yeah, for sure. And I think ultimately, to take a step back, one of the things we walk through in Christians in the age of outrage is not to walk the common path, or maybe even the social media path, but not just that, because it's your neighbors, your coworkers, your family members. You know, we're a couple months away from Thanksgiving, where and some of our listeners, I think, listen in Canada because of the network. So They're just now having Canadian Thanksgiving this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So when these things take place, man, there's there's opportunity for conflict there. So what I would say is walk the ancient paths. Spend more time in the Word. We actually go through this, and it may seem a little bit basic to people, but I got to tell you, I wake up every morning, my alarm goes off, beep, 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 on my cell phone, my iPhone, and then I pick up my phone, turn it off, and I can see Twitter notifications, Facebook notifications, Instagram notifications calling my name.
Wow.
And I can walk the path on those and join in, or I can put them down, take a few moments, pray, seek the Lord. I think ultimately, we begin to be in community with others, not just electrons and avatars, but feet and faces, real community with others. The end result is we're shaped differently and change really, really, really happens.
Mm-hmm. So what do you hope the readers will kind of resonate with your book?
Well, it surprised me I started writing this book over a year ago. And we did research that we actually added in at the last minute, so it could be super fresh research.
Nice.
So the research is a few months old, earlier this year. So every chapter begins with research about where we are in the division. But it's not a book for researchers. It's a book for Christians. But what I didn't know is that we'd be more mad at each other now than we were 6 months ago or a year ago. It only seems to be getting worse. Now, I don't think it's the most divided time our country's ever been. There was a civil war once many people may have heard of. But we're very, very divided. And Christians have been caught up in this, maybe in a way we haven't been before. And so what I just want to say is, let's think about how to stand up for what's right, how to advocate for what's best for society, and that includes things like life and many other issues, marriage, lots of other issues, but how to do so in a way that brings glory to God and looks more like Jesus and less like people trying to storm a castle with pitchforks and fire.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately, we're not thriving in that way. And I'm just saying, Christians, hey, there's a better way. For many Christians, this path you're on is not going to end well. And some of them, it's political. But Jesus isn't coming back on Air Force One.
He's
not
true.
Riding a donkey or an elephant. And so let's follow the King of Kings and how he calls us to engage culture.
So, Ed, if you ever get caught in a cash crunch, I'd buy one of your PhDs off you. Because obviously, you don't need two, seriously.
I don't need two.
And I would kind of like the idea of Dr. Bill Arnold, I'm just saying.
I like that. I'll call you that from now on, Dr. Arnold. I like that.
thank you so much. Ed Stetzer's been my guest.
You.
His book, Christians in the Age of Outrage, How to Bring Our Best When the World is at Its Worst. Check it out on Amazon.com. Have a great evening. Ed, thank you so much for being on the program. I'll be back with more in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. It's 31 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here. The hit parade continues. We had a fascinating conversation with Dr. Ed Stetzer, and now I get a chance to talk to Sheila Heen, which I'm very excited about. She's the founder of Triad Consulting Group and a lecturer on law at Harvard Law School. I've heard of that. She has spent the last 20 years with the Harvard Negotiation Project, developing negotiation theory and practice. Isn't that fascinating? She's written a book called Difficult Conversations, How to Discuss What Matters Most. Sheila, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about difficult conversations. Everybody has them, and nobody's good at them. So
yeah.
I am sitting at the feet of the master. Please teach me.
Oh, goodness sakes. Well, I think that you're – I think that was not supposed to be feedback to you, by the way. But I do think that we all have them. We have them in our work lives, and we have them in our personal lives. And And in many ways, although it can feel like there's something wrong with me that I can't figure out how to handle this situation, I do think actually they're just part of being human and being in relationship with each other.
Mm-hmm. So what happens when you say, okay, I'm going to try to speak my truth here, and I'm going to try to speak without being offensive, and yet it still doesn't go well? Where do you go from there?
Yeah, so a couple of thoughts. One is that although it's really important to speak our truth, we also have to be careful that it is our truth.
Mm-hmm.
And usually understanding together what the truth might look like. In other words, putting all of our pieces on the table to say, well, look, here's how I see it. Here's why this is important to me. Here's what I care most about. Here's how I felt, or here's what I think we should do. But putting that together with you putting the same things on the table from your perspective means that it's really a joint problem to try to figure out what can I learn from what you see that I can't see and vice versa. And then once we have a fuller picture, what are we going to do about that? And I think that's the process, which means that I have to actually be willing to hear something that doesn't initially make sense to me. Or that I didn't see and that might be new.
Are you always this calming?
I'm using my late night radio.
Okay. All right. So is the time and the way in which something is brought up, is that a key component to a conversation?
It is a key component, but I think sometimes we wait for what feels like some magical time where... Mm-hmm. where I can bring it up and you won't have any sort of reaction to it and I'll get what I want or get mm-hmm. my point across.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good recipe for putting it off forever.
Okay.
In many ways. I mean, what's really interesting about these conversations from my point of view is that if we really want to understand them, we actually have to look beyond what we're saying to each other, because we have to look at what we're really thinking and feeling in the midst of these conversations, because it's kind of x-ray vision into what's going on beneath the surface that helps us understand why we're having such a hard time.
Now, do we start a lot of these difficult conversations with emotion?
We do, and that's one of the things going on beneath the surface that's often fueling the energy of the conversation, that one or often both of us feel, you know, frustrated, disappointed, betrayed, guilty. And we also often have identity issues going on. If a conversation feels difficult, chances are there's something the situation suggests about me that is upsetting or feels like it's at stake. Like, am I a good person? Am I competent? Do you trust me? Should you trust me? And I may feel frustrated because I feel like you should trust me. You're misunderstanding me. You're mischaracterizing me. That's just as upsetting as if I think, ooh, gosh, I am not proud of how I handled that. But that's part of what turns up the heat in these conversations, is that often one or both parties feel like there's something the situation says about them that's on the table.
That's really interesting. I'm going to have to think about that. So we'll take I'll have this awkward pause here for a minute while I think.
How much time do you need?
Well, no, I just need a couple of seconds here to think and gather my thoughts. But if you're going to have a difficult conversation with somebody, let's say you must have an agenda. And then that should realistically, you should expect some kind of pushback or fight or battle or something?
Yeah, and I think that often the temptation is that I form my agenda, and my agenda is oriented around some almost messages I want to deliver to you.
Mm-hmm.
I need to explain to you that you're the problem here. And if you, Bill, could just
This is not personal right now, is it? Sheila,
yeah,
this is not.
No,
you're
no,
not
no.
being personal,
no.
are you?
No,
okay,
I've been hired by some of your so-called friends. So I think part of the problem is that we need to get out of the message delivery business to instead think about it as creating a learning conversation, where I have some concerns I want to share, I have some things I want to say as clearly as I can, and I want to hear your reactions to that and what you see that you think I'm missing.
Mm-hmm.
So that then together we're finding our way through. And, you know, you may or may not agree with what I have to say, and part of this is saying, that's okay. We may or may not need to agree at the end of the day, but we're going to be in a better place to figure out what to do if we have a better understanding of why we see this so differently.
Mm-hmm. If people say we can agree to disagree, does that mean they've agreed or disagreed?
It means they're giving up in the conversation. I mean, from a practical point of view, I think that that's often used as a way to get out of the conversation.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think often we come into these conversations feeling, my job is to persuade you that I'm right.
Uh-huh.
And then the point at which I say, I guess we'll have to agree to disagree, is I'm obviously not succeeding in persuading you that I am right.
Mm-hmm.
Usually I conclude it's because you just really don't get it or something is wrong with you. But the other feature of these conversations that's probably worth talking about is that another thing that sits under the surface is blame. So by the time we're having a difficult conversation, often it's because something feels like it's going wrong. We're each frustrated with each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so naturally, when something goes wrong, we want to know why. I mean, what's causing it? Whose fault is it? If you look at the earliest stories, right? Adam and Eve, there's only one rule.
Right.
They're not supposed to eat from that tree over there.
Yeah.
So, of course, they do. And then God comes back and says, you know.
What up? Yeah.
What up? And yeah, what does Adam say?
Yeah.
He says, she gave it to me. Right?
Yeah.
He blames Eve. And Eve says, don't look at me, that snake over there.
Yeah.
You know, talked me into it. And the snake's like, hey, don't look at me, I was possessed, man. You know?
Right.
So,
right.
But I think that it's reflective of something that I think is built into our humanity, which is that we want to know whose fault something is.
Yeah. Not to mention, I feel different about my present nudity right now as well.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that with us on the radio.
Well, no, I mean, I was going to Adam and Eve. You know what I'm talking about, because all of a sudden they were naked and ashamed.
Okay.
No,
okay.
No, I'm very clothed. Oh, boy. I'm glad my boss is on vacation right now. Otherwise, I may not have a job at the end of the day.
When you get calls about this, you can blame it on me for misunderstanding
okay.
your reference.
I was going back to Adam and Eve in the garden, you know, after they sinned, they were
that.
Naked and ashamed. Yeah. Let's move on.
We have a lot more listeners now, too. The thing that is the key is shifting from a blamed mindset to thinking about it as joint contribution. What did we each contribute to the problem here?
Mm-hmm.
We each did things or failed to do things, and those things might have been totally reasonable things to do, but they still had a bad impact, perhaps. And if we can figure out how we each contributed to getting to where we are today, that tells us what we could each change in order to not have this happen again,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah,
and be having the same problem and the same conversation next week and next year. And so that also shifts us from me versus you in the conversation about whose fault it is to, okay, we each had some part in it. It's not 50-50 probably, but that's how we're going to figure out how to solve this.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if this is typical of a lot of people, but when you are in a difficult conversation, you hear what's being said, but you also wonder or scratch your head about what wasn't said or what isn't being said.
Yeah.
How does that play into all of this?
Well, it's a great question because you're absolutely right that people's internal voice, like what they're really thinking, feeling, and not saying,
mm-hmm.
does tend to leak into the conversation, especially if there's emotion involved. Emotion is particularly likely to leak, the research tells us, through facial expressions and body language and tone of voice. Although even on email, emotion leaks in, right?
Oh, yeah.
In obvious ways, like caps, all caps.
Yeah, yeah.
But
stuff
also,
underlined.
You know, in tone, like the language choice, somebody's suddenly very curt or who's suddenly CC'd on the correspondence.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're reading not just the text, right? We're also reading the emotional cues that tell us that somebody is angry or upset or disappointed or frustrated, et cetera.
Yeah. So, is it ever wise to have a meaningful, serious conversation in texting?
Oh gosh, that's such a timely question. Not usually. The more important the conversation is, the harder it is to have in a meaningful way on either text or email, and that's partly because texting and email is not really dialogue; it's serial monologue.
Mm-hmm.
and there's just so much room for me to react to what you're saying before I even finish reading your email or
mm-hmm.
your text.
Yeah.
So the more important the conversation is, the more you need to either pick up the phone or, you know, talk about it in person, because you're going to get much more efficient about working it out. And if a conflict starts on text or email, I would assert that it's almost impossible to solve via text or email.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you've got to actually shift modes of communication to sort it out.
Yeah. So, Sheila, if we're in a difficult conversation and we start with emotion, and it probably has a little bit of possibly arguing that kicks in, mm-hmm. how do we get past that and get to a point where we're now doing something, what's the word, productive?
Mm-hmm. Well, so I think that our instinct when we are emotional is to try to keep the emotion out. And so we try to pretend it isn't there, and that actually makes it worse, because it's leaking out all over the place. It's experienced by the other person as passive aggressive,
mm-hmm.
because we're trying to be nice even while I am really not happy.
Yeah.
And everybody can tell. So counterintuitively, our advice is just be much more direct about the emotion. But being direct about emotion does not necessarily mean being emotional. In other words, if you can describe and name what you're feeling, look, it feels like we're going in circles and I'm confused about why, and I'm feeling a little frustrated and also anxious about whether we're going to figure this out in time. That's a perfectly reasonable thing to say, and cuts to the heart of what's going on much faster than me just acting frustrated and anxious and impatient
mm-hmm.
to get it solved.
Mm-hmm.
So actually naming the feeling up front, whether it's your own or the other person's, like, it sounds like you're frustrated, say a little bit more about that, will actually help move us forward rather than keep us sort of going in circles.
Mm-hmm. All right. I need to take a very short break. And then when I come back, I've got all kinds of questions still to ask. So Sheila Heena is my guest. It is 15 minutes until the top of the hour. Her book that we're discussing is called Difficult Conversations, How to Discuss What Matters Most. So if you want to jump in and ask a question, I would certainly have time for one. 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. That's phone number or a text. Either way works. Be back in a minute. Welcome back. The Big Hand is on the 47, so we've got 13 minutes until the top of the hour, and I'm going to be enjoying these 13 minutes with Sheila Heen. She's my guest, founder of Triad Consulting Group, and a lecturer on law at Harvard, and we're talking about having difficult conversations, how to discuss what matters most. And I'm curious, Sheila, why is expressing feelings so hard in good communication?
Oh, gosh.
Maybe that's just
me
talking.
There's so many answers to that question.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, say a little bit about what feels hard to you personally.
Well, if you have feelings of fear or anxiety or disappointment or hurt, and you bring that up, maybe I'm afraid that will be viewed as, oh, I can't believe you're that about, I can't believe you're disappointed about that, or I can't believe you feel that way. You know,
right.
I guess you're afraid of having your feelings diminished or maybe not validated.
Or dismissed.
Yep. Yeah, that's the word I was looking for.
Yep.
It started with a D. I couldn't think of what it was.
Yeah, or sometimes it can feel to the other person like you're blaming them for the feelings that you're having,
uh-huh.
which frankly sometimes we are, although we don't mean to be. Like, you shouldn't be making me so frustrated or
right.
disappointed. I think that's right. I also think that we labor under fantasy that we're hiding them, right? So I also don't want to show you my feelings, so I don't want to feel vulnerable or
mm-hmm.
make you think I care as much as I do occasionally. I think also sometimes we feel like we're not supposed to be having feelings in some contexts, like at work. Like, being a professional means that we stay calm all the time, when, of course, if you're a professional, it also means that the work is meaningful to you, that it matters to you whether you're doing a great job or achieving the impact you're trying to have on the world and for your customers. So of course you care. You need to care. And so I think we like to or hope to pretend that emotions don't matter when in fact emotions are part of what keep us coming to work, that keep us engaged in our work lives and in our personal relationships with other people.
All right. Let me ask you about listening. How important is that?
Yeah, no, it's not important at all.
Okay, let's move on to the next question then.
I'm sorry, I've been in one of those moods. What's funny is that I think all of your listeners would say, of course, listening is really important. Like, we believe that. So that raises the question, well, then why is it so hard to do in the middle of these conversations? Like, I consider myself a really pretty decent listener. It's important to me. I work hard at it. It's mm-hmm. my life's work, right? And yet there are still situations where my listening skills go totally out the window. And part of the problem is that my internal voice, what I'm thinking and feeling in particularly challenging conversations, gets turned up to full volume. So I'm actually jumping back and forth between trying to listen to the other person who's saying things that are ridiculous and infuriating, and actually listening to my own reactions. And so this is one of the reasons that listening goes out the window, because it's not that we're not listening, it's who are we listening to, and we're really trying to juggle too many things. And by the way, this is just a one-on-one conversation. Now you're sitting in a meeting mm-hmm. and trying to listen to a bunch of different people who aren't listening to each other because they're waiting their turn to say their piece or they're reacting in their minds to what everybody else is saying.
Uh-huh.
So the more people involved, the more complex it gets. And there's one more reason I think listening gets really challenging in these contexts, and it has to do with some of the neuroscience. So there's this thing called mirror neurons that some of your listeners may have been reading about lately. And it is simply describing a phenomenon. They're not a type of neuron. They're describing the phenomenon that when I watch something happen to you, if I care about you and I'm engaged with you, well then if something happens to you, you know, you fall down and are injured, I will have a mirror neuron reaction, meaning my own brain will have the same pattern as if I myself fell down. My own brain is imagining what it's like to be you. This is, by the way, why horror movies work. It's why spectator sports work, because the fans experience the thrill of the player's experience on the field, if that makes sense.
It does.
Now, that's great. That means we're wired for some empathy, apparently. But the hitch is that if I am actually upset with you, if I am angry with you, I'm apparently able to turn off that mirror neuron effect.
Hmm.
Not even consciously, but if I'm frustrated with you, I don't really care what's going on with you, frankly. And so my curiosity makes it me less likely to listen because I'm too preoccupied with my own reactions. And right now, I actually don't care what it's like to be you. So when we're hurt by other people or angry with other people, listening is not at all our instinctive reaction in the midst of that conversation.
That is so interesting.
Isn't it so interesting?
It is so interesting. Yeah.
And I imagine it's a self-protective feature, right? Mm-hmm. Like I kind of can't balance. I'm so overwhelmed that I kind of can't balance imagining what it's like to be you while I'm coping with what it's like to be me in this moment. But the problem is that it breaks the connection between us. And it's another reason why it's so hard for us to listen to each other when we feel frustrated or hurt. So all is not lost, by the way. It's not that you can't listen. But it's not going to be an instinctive reaction. It's got to be a trained response, a choice that you make to say, okay, I don't really want to hear what it's like to be you or why you disagree with me, but I'm actually going to – I know it's important. So it's like firefighters. It's nobody's instinctive reaction to run into a fire. But firefighters train long and hard in order to make a choice to run toward the danger. And in that, in many ways, that's a metaphor for this, which is leaning into the thing that feels frustrating or hard, because we know it's important for us in fellowship with each other to really try to understand each other.
Mm-hmm. Sheila, what about if the other person is just flat out difficult? And
do you want to name any names?
No, I don't. But maybe, or they're clearly a phony, and there's that little voice in your head that says, oh my gosh, this person is such a phony, and I know that I'm not getting the real truth of what's going on. They're putting on this little act, and it just, that makes me even crazier.
Oh, completely. Completely.
Yeah.
And by the way, what we would say you're describing is when it appears to me that what you're saying is totally out of alignment with what you really think and feel. That's what we would describe as being a phony. And that also has a huge impact on my willingness to trust you, right? If you're my leader and I think what you're saying to me is not what you actually think is true or what you actually know or believe, I'm not going to trust you as my leader. So part of what's hard about that is, number one, finding a little sliver of empathy, sympathy, or curiosity about why you might be doing that.
Okay, you got to say that again.
Yeah. So I need a little bit of empathy or maybe sympathy. In other words, gosh, if you feel like you can't say what you really think and feel for some reason, like that's got to be hard.
Yeah.
And I wonder why that would be. Like, why can't you just tell me what's really going on with you? So part of the challenge is that I need to keep in mind that I am negotiating with not just what you're saying. I'm trying to negotiate with and engage what you really think and feel. And I sometimes need to work pretty hard to invite you to say what you really think and feel, because you may not feel like you're allowed to, or that I'm going to react well, or whatever. But we're not going to get very far until I find a way to say, hey, you can say what you really think. And I can't totally tell. I need to be careful also how sure I am that you're being a phony.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you really believe it.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm kind of hearing is having a balance, and I don't even like the word balance, but to be able to have emotions and then rationality and then honesty and truthfulness and put that all in a pot and make it smell like a good smelling dinner, huh?
Yeah, I know, right? It's kind of a tall order, but there's also a way in which it's kind of a relief, because that's what we all want to be able to do and want other people to do with us. So if we could stop posturing or thinking that there must be magic words and just be more honest and authentic and open with each other, well, then we can find a way through this, which is not to say that it's always going to work out, or, you know, at some point we don't have to decide this isn't working. So the way we're currently in relationship with each other, whether that's at work or at home, needs to change.
Mm-hmm.
But at least we're dealing with whatever the real issues might be in ways that will help our relationship rather than continue to hurt our relationship.
Yeah. Sheila, you're a blast.
This has been so fun. I so enjoy this conversation. And when you get those phone calls, you know what to do. You can blame it on me.
Yeah, when I call
and
you
then,
saying I don't
I'll
have a job
And then I'll
call
back and we'll have a difficult conversation on the air. It'll be perfect.
All right. Would you come back on the show? Because I feel like there's more to talk about and we're out of time.
Oh, there's a lot more to talk about.
Okay.
There's definitely a lot more to talk about. And next time we'll take some calls because, you know, this is a huge pain point for all of us in our lives. And getting better at it makes everything better.
Okay. Sheila, thanks so much. Sheila Heen has been my guest, and you can go to her website, stoneandheed.com, S-T-O-N-E, and Heen, H-E-E-N.com. We'll take a short break and be back with more in a minute. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.